Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. Of Voltaire, it was said that he had no shade in his mind. Most of us, on most issues, have shaded minds. But we don't earn our livings purveying opinion. If we did, we'd find that ambivalence wouldn't get us very far on today's op-ed pages. The war has put many commentators in touch with their inner Douglas MacArthurs. Others have not altered their critique of American power by so much as a comma since September 11th. Listeners, do you have shade in your minds over the origin and justice of America's war on terrorism? Trade opinions with our guest, two widely cited intellectuals who never cease from mental fight. First, a critical look at the U.S. air war in Afghanistan. We are now in the 10th day of the military campaign. Today, low-flying AC-130s bombed military sites in the Taliban strongholds of Kabul, Kandahar, and Mazar-e-Sharif. News reports have described a blitz of increasing intensity. But military analyst William Arkin says that Americans are getting a false impression of this war. I spoke to him earlier from his home in Pomfret, Vermont. Arkin said that September 11th had made Americans more hawkish, but the military more hesitant.
We've seen during the entire Clinton administration the use of force in order to achieve humanitarian objectives or policy objectives that the American people weren't necessarily behind in their heart and soul, Somalia, even Kosovo. And I think that one of the things that you saw as a result of that was that the use of force was always very hesitantly applied. There was never clarity in the part of the White House whether or not people were going to actually support the use of force. I remember very clearly an appearance of Madeleine Albright at Ohio State University before one of the bombings of Iraq in 1998, where she got booed and heckled. And that was a real eye-opener for them. The American people didn't necessarily support the use of force in pursuit of these policy objectives. After September 11th, everything changed. I think the American public not only wanted to use force, but they wanted, at the same time, not to repeat the old style of the Clinton years, not to do something remotely, not to do something hesitantly. I think that there was a real mandate that the president had to use force. The irony of the way in which the air campaign has unfolded in Afghanistan is that it communicates exactly the opposite. Our hesitancy to take casualties, the modesty of our attacks themselves, and I think ultimately because the Bush administration, maybe for very sound military reasons and sound logistical reasons, has not put ground forces or special operations troops on the ground in Afghanistan yet, it is also suggested to people that, in fact, the war might be won remotely, that is, without boots on the ground, that is, without casualties.
Are you also suggesting that if we were to do that, were to put ground forces in there, we would then get away from the air war, and would that help us in the propaganda campaign because we wouldn't have images on CNN and elsewhere of buildings of mud huts blowing up all the time?
Well, you know, we're in a real pickle now because it seems that we have a little bit lost the information war. When I hear people, even in my little town in Vermont, say to me, oh, we blew up the Red Cross today, as if I'm a general and I'm supposed to defend that. You know, you have to answer, okay, now let's look at this with some degree of proportion here. 6,000 Americans died, and we're waging an air campaign against the Taliban and against Osama bin Laden and his network, and there have been two or three confirmed incidents where civilians have died as a result of the waging of this campaign. I'm not defending the Air Force. Civilian casualties are going to be a part of any campaign. Mm-hmm. Am I satisfied that they are doing everything that they can to avoid civilian casualties? Absolutely. Are we using a huge proportion of precision-guided weapons in this war, even a larger proportion than we used in the Yugoslav War? Yes. But some targets are more suitable for dumb bombs. And when you see the B-52s or the B-1s dropping these 1,000-pound dumb bombs, they're doing so in remote areas on fielded formations, and if the secondary explosions from those or some of those bombs go off base and civilians die, we have to ask ourselves as Americans whether or not that is proportionate to what it is that the objectives are that we're trying to achieve in fighting this war. We're fighting a war because somebody killed 6,000 American civilians. If a couple of hundred Afghan civilians die at the end of this campaign in order to take down the Taliban and take down al-Qaeda, I'm happy to say to you, I think that that is about the most just and circumscribed military campaign waged in history.
And what about U.S. casualties? How many U.S. battle deaths should we anticipate, and how many should we be willing to accept in this endeavor to eliminate al-Qaeda?
Well, you know, I had a conversation with a senior Air Force officer yesterday, and I asked him the question about, you know, sort of the choreography of the bombing, and one of his answers was, well, you know, these guys are not going to have winter quarters to return to once the weather gets worse. And I said, when you say that, it says to me that this is going to go on much longer than the American public thinks it's going to go on for. And he says, well, the president has been saying, Secretary Rumsfeld has been saying this is a long-term campaign. And I said, no, I understand they're saying it. I said, has it really gotten into the American psyche yet? And he said, no, probably it hasn't. And I said, are you hitting bridges? And he said, no, we're not hitting bridges because we might need those bridges later on to maneuver our own forces, to move around ourselves. And so you can see that they are being much more careful. They're being much more clever about what they bomb as well as what they don't bomb because they're preparing themselves for this long-term campaign. Now, what is the prospects of succeeding in this campaign, as fancy as it might be, a campaign that's trying to incorporate all of that information warfare and intelligence technologies that we've matured since the Gulf War? I think the answer is still fairly low.
The prospects of success are low, you think? Success,
yes.
Defined as ripping out al-Qaeda, destroying the parts of the Taliban that have sheltered al-Qaeda, and perhaps even getting bin Laden. You don't think those things are as easy to do as it perhaps may seem now?
We have a conceptual problem in dealing with Taliban and al-Qaeda, and that is that we fight wars against states.
Mm-hmm.
We fight wars against nations, where we come to the table with the assumption that the nation, the state, has national interests at stake. It does what it thinks is in its interests. The Taliban is not a nation state. The Taliban is a movement.
Right.
They are no more likely to turn over Osama bin Laden than they are likely to do what is in their best interest, which is to seek their own survival.
William Arkin is a journalist and military analyst. I spoke to him earlier from his home in Pomfret, Vermont. Is it unpatriotic to dissent during wartime? You can join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. With us now is Katha Pollitt, a columnist for The Nation. She joins us from New York. And in the Washington studios of Monitor Radio is Andrew Sullivan. He's a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and a senior editor at The New Republic. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Jack.
Hello. Andrew Sullivan,
hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Katha Pollitt, is this a just war?
Well, that's a tough question, isn't it? I would say it's not a war like the war in Vietnam, which we sort of went looking for when Ho Chi Minh had done nothing to us. However, I think there are real questions about what our government has chosen to do.
And what are those questions?
I think the questions are bombing Afghanistan, a country that is already practically in the Stone Age, to get rid of the Taliban, who will be replaced by the Northern Alliance and the, quote, moderate Taliban, unquote, whatever that is. And I don't think that we've thought it through. I think this is a very complicated situation having to do with many, many countries. Our president has said, you know, we're going to follow the terrorists wherever they are. Well, what? Germany? They were going to school in Hamburg, you know? I just have a lot of questions about where this is all going to lead. I know there have been, you know, some people are talking that Pakistan may fall. You know, there are a lot of parts of Pakistan that are very Talibanized, as they say, and the Pakistani army is very full of supporters of the Taliban. So I think I just would like to know more than we're being told at the present moment.
You had a disagreement with your daughter recently about the American flag.
Yeah, my daughter's famous now, the famous patriot.
Great. Can you tell our listeners about your conversation?
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, she's in the other room, and she'll probably come in here and want to talk to you.
Well, let's hear from
talk
her.
To you. But, my daughter said in the wake of the World Trade Center, which was, you know, deeply, deeply disturbing to people in New York, and especially people who went to my daughter's school, Stuyvesant, which is four or five blocks from the World Trade Center, and there were kids in the building who saw just horrible things, and the power failed, and they were all just sent home and had to walk home because the subways weren't working. And, you know, it was a very big event in the life of my daughter and her friends. And she said, well, you know, we should have a flag. And I said, well, I don't think so. To me, a flag stands for war. And it stands for jingoism, a kind of, you know, do or die, my country right or wrong patriotism that I don't, quote, patriotism, unquote. I wouldn't call it patriotism. I would call it chauvinism that I don't subscribe to. And she said, well, I think the flag stands for grieving for the dead and saying you can't do this for us and, you know, we're against terrorism. And so I said to her, well, you could buy a flag with your own money, which is, of course, as any parent of a teenager knows, means it isn't going to happen. You can fly it out your bedroom window because, you know, she has freedom of speech in this house, but the living room is a grown-up space. And that was our compromise. And I got, you wouldn't believe how much mail I got. You just wouldn't believe it. They put my piece up on, the Nation put my piece up on the web. And then you get a whole other kind of reader than you get from people who read The Nation in its print form, you can imagine. So
not the initiates.
Right, you atheistical bitch, and you have no right to be raising such a commonsensical fine daughter. And then this was picked up by the New York Post, and the Weekly Standard had a sort of send a flag to Miss Pollitt campaign.
Have you got any flags?
They got a few, but I'll tell you an interesting thing. I did mention in my next column, two alternative flags. One was, I mean, it's a little hippy-dippy, but I thought, why not? One was called the peace flag, which is like the American flag, but it has the stars are shaped in a peace sign. And since my piece came out, their website has been hacked, has been turned into a porn site. They've received death threats.
Oh, dear.
Yeah,
This is a country at war. Andrew Sullivan, are you with Miss Pollitt or Ms. Pollitt on this one?
Well, obviously I'm not. Neither is almost anybody in the country. I noticed that Katha still hasn't answered the question, is this a just war or not?
Well, what do you say to that?
If you can be in New York City and watch as 6,000 Americans are massacred a few blocks away from you by people who are avowedly racist, misogynistic, homophobic, sexist, fascistic, and want to continue this war against American citizens and already terrorizing large numbers of them, and you cannot say that it is just to respond to that kind of violence, then I think you've got a real problem.
Well, I guess I think I'd like to...
What would you have us do, Katha? Sit around, hug them?
No, of course not. And I think, you know, that kind of discourse, Andrew, I think I'd like it if we could stay away from that. That's like when when calling Susan Sontag a traitor, talking about the fifth column, all that kind of stuff.
I find it equally offensive when you call Old Glory a symbol of war, when it is a symbol of this country and its history and its traditions and its freedoms, which are currently under assault from a force that is clearly evil. And if you cannot support the flying of the flag which unites this country at such a time, there is something seriously morally awry with your position.
Well, maybe what I went on to say in my column is that I feel that these issues are global issues. I don't think this is just an us versus them thing, although, of course, it has that aspect too. But these are enormously complex global problems. This is not just about Afghanistan. In fact, it's barely about Afghanistan. And after the Taliban has been overthrown, Afghanistan is still going to be a wretched place where all kinds of terrible things are bred.
Katha, hold that thought just for a second.
Sorry.
What is patriotism? How do intellectuals on the right and left see this war? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking this hour about the war against terror through different lenses. How do you see it? Are you surprised to find yourself a flag waver? What kind of America do you want to live in? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255, or join us on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Our guests are Andrew Sullivan, a senior editor at The New Republic, and Katha Pollitt, a columnist for The Nation. Andrew Sullivan, you have written that this war has or should humiliate the left. What do you mean by that? Who are the left, and why are they? Why should they be humiliated?
I don't know whether that's a direct quote, but I think that what I have said is that the instant response of the far left, which was not the whole left, because many parts of the left have been quite clear-minded about this. The National Organization of Women, for example, took a very strong and brave stand against the Taliban. People like Christopher Hitchens have noticed that Islamofascism is real and destructive of our liberties and a real enemy to our freedoms. And NAACP has also taken that position. Magazines like The American Prospect and indeed The New Republic, both Gore-supporting Democratic magazines, have taken a very firm stance against any sort of pusillanimity in response to what is an obvious massive assault upon this country, an act of war unlike which we've never seen in the history of the United States. But some aspects of the left, and I would call them the far left, the decadent left, so loathes what this country stands for, its freedoms and its role in the world, that even when 6,000 Americans are murdered, they cannot actively denounce the act and actively support an attempt to bring the people to justice. I agree with the Labour Prime Minister in Britain, Tony Blair, that the people who equivocate in those circumstances should be ashamed. And they harbor an anti-Americanism, a hostility to this country's freedoms that is truly, in Katha's words, deeply, deeply disturbing. I can't imagine Londoners during the Blitz, as their city was being bombed, sitting around saying, well, you know, it's all deeply, deeply disturbing, or telling their children they cannot fly the Union Jack, or telling them that patriotism, well, you don't think it's a noble thing and you wouldn't do it yourself.
Well,
what is so wrong with America? I mean, put it this way, if a woman was raped, and you were standing nearby, would your first response be, well, she shouldn't have been wearing that dress?
Or would it have been,
let us bring the rapist to justice?
And your argument is exactly the same. I can't respond to that. That's idiotic. Now, the fact is about the
Taliban. I have been writing about
the Taliban for years.
Indeed you have, Katha.
Yes, I have.
For years.
The Taliban, you know, there is an aspect of this where Islamic fundamentalism of the sort that we're now, you know, suffering under was bankrolled by the United States. You know, don't forget that. I mean, there was a piece that's going around the web from an interview that Brzezinski gave to Le Monde in 1998, where he said, oh, yeah, Jimmy Carter and I started the whole thing. We gave them a lot of money to get rid of the Soviets, and that was good, and that was, you know, that was the important thing, and I don't, you know, it's fine what's happening now.
Katha, if, I don't agree with you, but if we played a part in the past, unwittingly, as it turns out, to create the situation, isn't it more incumbent upon us to rectify it now rather than sit back and do nothing?
No, I'm not saying, did I say sit back and do nothing?
The implication is that we do. What should we do, Katha?
What do you think we should do? Well, I think, for example, I would say, first of all,
Stammering is eloquent.
Hold that thought.
Is that fair? I'm trying to give.
She's
a
trying to be thoughtful here.
I'm talking about
if you haven't thought
like
it out by now, when are you going to think it out?
Andrew, hold that.
Yeah, just hold that thought. I would say we need to talk about Israel, we need to talk about Iraq, we need to talk about the fact that millions and millions and millions of people in the Arab world have no hope at all. They're growing up in garbage dumps. When they get education, they can't use it. They're being
raised.
Stop changing
the subject, Catherine. What
it's not the subject.
Do?
It's not. No, I'm not changing the subject. What I'm saying is we have a terrible world situation that produces this kind of thing. But anyone who says that, anyone who says this is something more than evil maniacs, is called a traitor.
And, of course, you're not justifying the attack. You're just saying that these are these circumstances.
No.
Yes.
No, it's horrible.
Right.
It's horrible.
Of course.
It's evil. And, of course,
right.
I think those terrorists should be brought to justice. Of course they should. I'm not saying, like, oh, you poor babies, yes, you're upset about something, so go blow up some things in America.
Right.
No.
Right.
And I don't think anybody's really saying that. I think that is a gross distortion some serious positions.
Let's hear from our callers. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Garrett is on the line. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Welcome.
It's interesting. I've been listening to this conversation. It's starting to sound like I've only read this in a transcript, but I've read a transcript of a debate between John Silber and Noam Chomsky. And it seems to be that Mrs. Paul is playing the role of Mr. Chomsky, while Andrew Sullivan's playing the hypocritical role of John Silber and being very arrogant. So anyways...
Hypocritical? Why hypocritical? He believes what he's saying?
Well, he's really not letting her get out her point.
Well, I think we've got some. But what's your point?
Well, I called up to mention... there's a couple of things. I'm not really sure where I stand on this world, but I will tell you one thing about patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me to know. I'd be interested to see. You see all these people running around flying flags and putting them on their cars, and you got the Don't Tread on Me flags, et cetera, et cetera. I'd be interested to know how many of those people actually voted in the last election. 51% of this country voted, and yet you've seen this great outpouring of nationalism, great outpouring of patriotism, more nationalism. It depends, I think, on who you talk to. The nationalists tending not to think. If you look at the people who the patriots, I mean, I'm willing to bet some of them probably voted. Most of the veterans, I'd be willing to bet, and probably the union unionized workers.
But you wonder about the moral content of American patriotism when half of the people. Vote.
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to really wonder if it's sort of a trendy type thing. I mean, I'm in high school and I've seen kids. I've seen a lot of kids putting up like American flags in their cars. I put the American flag, but I also got the POW flag to put on there, and I also put I have an old Vietnam War protest flag with the peace sign and the Union Jack. I think it's not the one that Mrs. Paul. Is it Mrs. or Miss?
Ms. Paul.
Ms. Paul. I read your column, by the way. I thought it was great. Ms. Paul.
Thank you.
Garrett, I think we get where you're coming from. You have a mind with some shade in it. Andrew Sullivan, what about
please,
that?
Jack. I mean, it is not a question of having shade if you actually equivocate in front of evil. It is not an admirable thing to have shade when you're dealing with what is clearly an act of war upon your country. And stop loading the question so that anybody that says an atrocity is committed, it is an evil and we have to respond to it, as if that's somehow crude. It is not crude to know the difference between right and wrong. You're loading this in such a way that somehow talk, that's to analyze all the... Of course we need to understand the global context of this. Of course we have to understand the context of religious fundamentalism in the Middle East and of rabid anti-Semitism and the growth of terrorism and indeed the United States history in the CIA and the FBI and so on of ignoring this. Of course, no one's saying we shouldn't have those discussions, but at the same time, we have to decide what we're doing and whose side we're on. And clearly this is an attack upon the West, upon its freedoms, and upon our lives of themselves. And if we cannot say that in those contexts we need to bring these people to justice, and we need to do so firmly and quickly in order to stop further attacks, then I think we really are lost, morally and politically.
Bob is on the line with a question for Kath Apollett.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do have two questions for Kath. I'll go through them quickly here. First of all, Kath, can you give us a historic example that justifies your position? In other words, if people are attacked, 6,000 people or some similar proportion is killed, and the nation does what that's not violent? That's my first question. The second question is, you're in FDR's cabinet. It's December 8th, 1941. How do you justify to him declaring war on Germany when, in fact, it was Japan who attacked us? And do you support that decision he made? And if you don't support it, how could you stand in context now to say that?
I think that, yes, we had to we declared war on Germany because they were the allies of Japan, right? Before Pearl Harbor, there was not a lot of support for going to war against Germany. There was a lot of support, in fact, for Germany in the United States. Your second question, I'm drawing a historical blank on, so you'll have to forgive me there.
Well, he's just saying, what would you have done on December 8th? Would you have said, let's talk about the Japanese complaints? Let's look into this.
The Japanese were an enormous imperialist power. They had invaded China. They had killed all kinds of things. I am not saying mm-hmm. I have not said that there should be no response,
right.
And I have not either said that there should be, just a big hug fest for the Taliban. I mean, this is like the New Republic saying that Susan Sontag was like Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, because she said there's a world situation out here that we should try to understand.
So you're trying to speak up.
What I'm saying mm-hmm. is, I don't think that whatever happens in Afghanistan is going to be the end of the story here. And mm-hmm. I think people are being told that. The end of the story of the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Taliban will be incorporated into whatever new regime they have in Afghanistan. It's going to be horrible. It's not going to be great for women, because the Northern Alliance are bad for women too.
But Katha, if the terrorist network is destroyed and if Americans are therefore more secure, isn't that a worthy war aim, an objective the United States is justified in pursuing?
That might work for a while, but I think these terrorist networks, it's not just people sitting around saying let's kill ourselves and kill some other people too. I think there are social forces that produce these people. For example, our great ally Saudi Arabia. I mean, look how many of these people came from Saudi Arabia, and mm-hmm. one of the big grievances they have is that we have bases in Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia is also a clerical fascist state, but it's our ally.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, look,
women in Saudi Arabia.
Katha, in the war against Nazism, Stalin's Soviet Union was our ally. No war is going to be morally pure. And if you want to have a completely clean slate in history, you're never going to find one. What you do have to acknowledge is that what was done to this country is the greatest act of war upon the homeland of the United States in the history of this country. And the response to that has to be firm and clear, or it is going to invite further attacks upon this country and other free countries around the world.
And I
would love to know what your response would be if it had been discovered that the Ku Klux Klan had destroyed those two towers. Would you be going around asking, let us understand the socioeconomic conditions that lead people to be fascists in the United States? Of course you wouldn't. And it's just this inability of the left now, because the left, remember, has absorbed the notion there are no absolute truths. There is no absolute right and wrong. Everything is relative. Stanley Fish and Noam Chomsky are the purveyors of this particular doctrine. They cannot see this event and say it's wrong. And that's what you hear in Katha's inability to make clear moral statements about this, or bring up other issues, other questions, other contexts.
What about the clear moral statement that here we are dropping 30,000 rations a day on the starving Afghans? There are millions of starving Afghans. Mary Robinson, who, you know, at the UN, she said there is an enormous humanitarian crisis there that is being worsened mm-hmm. by this war. So is this going
to
be another kill
to
the, you know, burn down
that.
The village in order to save it? I mean, I don't have any answers, and I am honest about that.
Well, thank you for clarifying that, Katha. You have no answers.
And
that's a very clarifying moment.
Well, you know, your answer may not be the right answer. It's not maybe
it
not
may
always
not,
the right
and
thing.
I'm,
maybe it's not
it may
always.
Not, and I think we need to have a debate about exactly what the right response is, how we make it effective,
but
how we bring these terrorists to justice, how we get rid the world of this
blight.
Andrew,
you have spent much too much time on television. You should let me finish my sentence. But to go back to your point of, like, what if this was the Ku Klux Klan doing something terrible? I wouldn't be in favor of bombing Alabama. You keep talking about acts of war. An act of war is committed by a government. The Ku Klux Klan is not a government with a nation, and the Al-Qaeda network is not a government. It's a collection of, criminals.
Right, which finds itself protected by a government.
If the mafia had done this, we wouldn't blow up Sicily.
Yeah. Hey, let's hear from one of our callers. Jeff is on the line.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. It seems to me that the two positions of Kath Apollo and Andrew Sullivan have some overlap. I mean, not that they're not mutually exclusive. I feel like I'm a thinking person, and I know that we're living in a global world where all the countries need to get along. And I hung a flag out after this terrible thing happened. And I know that in America's history, we've done some terrible things, some things that weren't right. But I think by hanging the flag out there, I'm just saying that I'm not only saying that, yes, I feel a sense of national unity with people in America, but I think the flag also stands for all of those things that are that mean civilization and that we should all be feeling in our place in the world.
Sure.
So I just don't understand why we can't be given credit for being intelligent people and hanging our flags out and knowing that it means not only national unity, but also a sense of being part of the new global civilized world.
Mm-hmm. Kath Apollo, what about that? Complicated feeling about flying the flag.
Yeah,
you don't necessarily support jingoism. You support values. You support what's decent
true.
About America.
Right now, the flag means a lot of things. It means different things to different people. For example, I think, you know, if you're a Pakistani cab driver, it could mean I'm an American, too. It could mean don't beat me up. If you're, you know, for my daughter, it meant it was a sign of grief and unity. And I say that in my piece, and I accept that. And I think, you know, I'm not against other people flying the flag.
Sure.
I was talking about what I wanted
sure.
in my
yeah.
living room.
Right.
I think, you know, it's been sort of taken a little bit out of context. For me, growing up with the Vietnam War and being part of the anti-war movement, the flag has some other connotations that come.
But Catherine, it's time for you to move on.
What?
It's time for you to move on.
Well, we'll see about that, Andrew.
This is not the Vietnam War, Katha. The world has changed. We are dealing with a force now. Read Bin Laden's material. Read what they are saying. They want to rid the entire Middle East of any non-Muslims. They want to kill and expel every Jew. They want Lebensraum from the entire part of the Middle East, and they are armed and deadly. And they are also trying to get their hands on nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. At some point, you've got to take this deadly seriously. And yes, let's be intelligent about this, but don't ignore the incredible threat that this country and the civilized world is now facing.
Katha, you're not going to avoid the threat?
But what I'm saying is, okay, you believe, here's where our maybe part of our difference lies. You believe that by bombing Afghanistan and dethroning the Taliban and rooting out the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan, that this is going to be a turning point. I just wonder how true that is.
I think it's a beginning. And I don't think we're bombing Afghanistan. We're not. We are bombing specific military and terrorist targets in Afghanistan, and we are doing one of the most surgical and careful wars that we have ever done. And to foment this propaganda that somehow we're bombing the Afghan people when we're sending them food aid, we have no quarrel with them, but we're trying to get rid of the tyranny that has also persecuted them and the terrorists that are funding that tyranny
yes.
and want to fund it throughout the world.
Indeed. What is patriotism, listeners? How do intellectuals on the right and left see the war on terrorism? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forum. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. This hour, we're looking at the war from the left and the right. Are you waving the American flag or waving a red flag of caution? Join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Our guests are Andrew Sullivan, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and Katha Pollitt, a columnist for The Nation. Bertha is on the line. Hello.
Hi. The thing that's bothering me is that there was not a single Afghani or Pakistani on any of those planes on the 11th of September.
Mm-hmm.
and we're bombing the dickens out of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Considerably more diplomatic work needed to be done. I think we rushed into something that no country has harmed us, some maniacal group of people, and we don't really even know who they were.
But do you accept the idea that sovereignty brings with it the obligation to keep your state from being, a safe ground for terrorists? That is to say, the Afghan government...
I certainly think that that's what sovereignty means, and I think that our FBI and our CIA should have been a lot more on the ball about this, and I don't think that sovereignty means going and bombing somebody just because we think they did it.
Hmm. Andrew Sullivan?
I think we know they did it. We know exactly that al-Qaeda was behind this, and we know that al-Qaeda's relationship with the Taliban is not as some sort of loose relationship. It is the primary funding for the entire regime of the Taliban. It is an inseparable unit, and it is also linked, of course, in a web of network across the globe to create terror and foment hatred of anybody that doesn't adhere to the most extremist Muslim doctrine. So I don't think this is about nationalities as such. It's about who actually committed this act. We know it. We know where they are. We know which regime is harboring them, and we have to go after them. And we haven't rushed into anything. We took a month before we made any actual serious military moves, and I think that President Bush is to be commended for the extraordinary measured tone and focused tone with which he's honed this military campaign.
Andrew, go ahead, Bertha. Is that Bertha on the line?
No, that was actually me.
Oh, okay.
That was actually me trying to interject something. Well, you know, I think it's very interesting that the three countries that bankroll the Taliban and have supported and acknowledged its legitimacy were all American allies: Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Pakistan. And, I just want to say again that I think that it's just too simple a picture to say that the bad guys are in Afghanistan and we're going to get them and then the problems will be solved. I
agree with you,
Katha,
and I think the Saudis have an awful amount to answer for. So does Pakistan. All that suggests to me, though, is that the problem of this extremist Islamofascism is really, really more widespread than we want to believe. And, in fact, we are dealing with a phenomenon that is terrifying in its scope. The reason these Saudis and Pakistanis are paying off these people is because they're terrified of them. They really believe that they're up against the wall, and Saudis know that if they don't pay basically protection money to these people, their regime is the next to go under. It's a terrifying situation, and I agree that the United States and the West bear some responsibility for our negligence over the last 10 years, just as we bore some responsibility for the negligence in the 30s,
so would you be in
while
favor
the Nazis
of destroying
grew.
The House of
but
Saudi?
That negligence doesn't mean we should like in the 30s. The negligence of the 30s doesn't mean that the 40s we shouldn't fight. Mm-hmm. It means that we should have fought before and that we shouldn't use that, as some people did in Britain and indeed in the West in the 30s, to really advocate defeat.
And it should mean...
Which I think de facto, mm-hmm. even though I don't believe you want this, I think that de facto your arguments mean our defeat.
Katha's arguments mean our defeat?
You mean
absolutely. I agree with George Orwell, who said in the 40s that because there is no possibility of dissent among the Nazis and there is dissent in Britain, the pacifists in Britain in 1940, 41, 42 were de facto pro-Nazi. I don't mean that that's their intent, but the effect of this is simply to say we give in. Mm-hmm. And that is the effect of doing nothing. That is the effect of simply talking.
I don't think I've said we should do nothing. I never said we should do nothing.
Well, you haven't told us what you want us to do.
We have to put Israel and Iraq on the table. We have to rethink our whole attitude toward that part of the world. We have to foster development and democracy and all that kind of thing.
But you're saying that, Katha, as a way of trying to eliminate some of the irritants between us and that part of the world.
That's right.
Yeah, and this isn't, after all, a treasonous line of thought. I mean, just before the bombing, former congressman from Indiana, Lee Hamilton, concluded a trip through the Middle East with a commission, presidential commission, that said that, the main foreign policy problem we have there is resentment.
Yes.
Anger is a security problem right now, but it's the resentment. And anything we can do to lift that, which isn't connecting it at all with bin Laden.
And don't you think it was interesting, Jack and Andrew, that, you know, we walked out of the racism conference in Durban, it was just a couple of weeks before this happened, saying, oh, it's all, you know, they just want to talk about the Middle East. Who cares? You know? Who cares about the Middle East? That has nothing to do with any of this.
The same,
you know, I think there's a real
fanatics
there,
I just were running
think,
Durban.
I think people are very reluctant to really think this through. That's my only point. And the people who say that, my other point is, get called, you know, oh, you're just like a Nazi, or you're a traitor, or you're like Susan Sontag, you know. Now, I want to bring up another thing about dissent, which is that I do think it's, and maybe, Andrew, you even agree with me about this, that under the cover of what C. Wright Mills called the rhetoric of emergency, some things are being done in this country that I think are going to have very bad effects, and one of them is this anti-terrorism bill that was passed by the Senate a couple of days ago, 96-1. The only person who voted against it was Russ Feingold. I guess he's sorry now that he voted to confirm Ashcroft as Attorney General, and I think that has some very disturbing provisions in it. For example, that you could detain non-citizens without judicial review forever. Information sharing among the FBI and the CIA, which means the CIA would be allowed to spy in this country. Roving wiretaps. I don't think these things have been explained to the American people at all.
But don't you
think?
Well,
they were defeated many times before in the 1990s, as you know. And the question at this point, you talk about the rhetoric of emergency. If this is not an emergency, Katha, what is?
Well, I would say,
when we are dealing with an enemy do you doubt for a minute that if they had a nuclear capability, they would be using it? Do you doubt that for a second?
I think if they had the Tooth Fairy, they'd use that, but they don't have nuclear weapons. But you know what?
They are close to it.
Pakistan
they have regimes in the Middle
weapons.
East that want to give it to them.
Pakistan has nuclear weapons. But I guess what I have to say is I think you are employing the rhetoric of emergency. You're saying, well, if they have a nuclear bomb, we should be able to lock up some people forever without giving them a trial.
I'm sorry, I don't want to wait, Katha, until there is a nuclear bomb exploded in this country before we take action. We have to be vigilant. And they have made their aims perfectly clear, and we know the methods they have. And unless we take real action against them, we are going to have a calamity in this country sooner rather than later. And at this point, yes, the rhetoric of emergency is justified because this is an emergency.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think what makes this country a wonderful and special place is our regard for civil liberties, and I don't think we should give that up. And every time in our history when we have done that, it's always been, oh, right, this is different, this is the end. You know, the McCarthy era was like that. The Alien and Sedition Act was like that. It's not a happy suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War was like that. It's not a happy
But haven't we
learned something from that past history, Katha? For example, some of these provisions are sunsetted. They're going to run the length of the emergency and then come off, as opposed to earlier measures. Isn't that at least showing some regard for what the past has told us about civil liberties
and
wartime?
Well, I think that's a good part of it. That is good. But, however, I just think that this is happening with so little discussion, so little dissent, I find very disturbing.
We've had 15 years of discussion of this, Katha, as you know.
Yeah,
and when people could discuss
it in a calm way, they didn't like it. But
they killed
it.
They killed the legislation that might have allowed us to know that these people were in the country. This was a massive failure of intelligence, and it was partly because many of the measures that should have been taken before September 11th were not taken because people, frankly, like you, opposed them. And at some point, you've got to ask yourself, 5,000 people are dead.
Oh, no, wait. Please, do not.
People like me who oppose these things, they would have been passed in a minute.
Yeah.
There were many, many people who were opposed to these things for very good reasons, people on the right and people on the left. People
of course,
from
including
all
Bob
over
Barr,
the spectrum
the
who value the Fourth Amendment, our protection from unreasonable search and seizure, and do not want to be treated like everyone in the country being treated like a potential terrorist, or every Muslim being treated like a potential traitor, Middle Eastern descent being racially profiled.
Katha, thank you. Andrew Sullivan, thank you. Andrew Sullivan is a senior editor at The New Republic and writes daily on his website, andrewsullivan.com. Katha Pollitt is a columnist for The Nation. Her recent book is Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. To continue the conversation, go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, a different Afghanistan. Andrew Brescia fondly remembers the Kabul of his childhood. He went to school while his father worked with the United States Information Agency in an Afghanistan marked by beauty, not war.
For four wonderful years, I lived at 6,000 feet above sea level. I was in fourth grade when I arrived and had finished seventh grade when our family left for lower altitudes. Some of the people I went to school with had family names that would sound familiar to most Americans. Others had names like Khan and Abdullah and Azim. They were Pakistani, Bengali, Iranian, Jordanian, and Saudi Arabian. And some were Afghan. We all went to school together at the American International School of Kabul. I grew up playing soccer on dusty, hard-packed fields in Afghanistan where the players shouted, laughed, and muttered in more than one language. For 4 years, I rode my bike through many unnamed streets in Kabul. With its small front tire, it was a perfect bike for wheelies, and it was bright orange. I received my first communion in Kabul from an Italian priest who spoke seven languages fluently and made incredible gnocchi. On the king's birthday, I watched men on horseback playing games of bushkashi with a headless goat. I played on flag football teams and softball teams, and once I played with gunpowder, which we could buy in any bazaar and which could singe my friend's eyebrows. I watched parades as Soviet-built tanks left teeth marks in the summer-warmed asphalt. My summer days were spent on clay tennis courts with my Jimmy Connors T-2000 and lessons with Muzmir, a Pakistani coach who left me with a more reliable backhand than forehand. In the summers, our family would travel into the mountains of Afghanistan. In Bandiamir, I looked out over the bluest pool of water I have ever seen. I rode on horseback through the Hindu Kush Mountains on narrow paths littered with pieces of raw lapis. One summer, we took a family trip to Bamiyan, where everyone but my mother stood on the tallest standing Buddha in the world. The Taliban have now made that impossible. Some years ago, after Soviet troops had invaded Afghanistan, I drove into Boston with a friend, also an English teacher, to join walkers raising money for Afghan children dismembered by landmines. The bumper sticker on my car at the time read, "Free Afghanistan." Now, after September 11, Afghanistan is in our newscasts and conversations again, and yet once more, Afghanistan needs to be freed from an occupying force. One Afghan writer likens the Taliban, the self-named Students of Islam, to the Nazi force that occupied Poland. This time, though, primetime TV shows like The West Wing are helping us out with ways to learn the many lessons of September 11 and, indirectly, more about a land invaded and occupied and depleted and fragmented so many times in its long and troubled history. All this brings me back, finally, to one more memory from growing up in Kabul. In an accident I witnessed in that now distant and peaceful Kabul, an Afghan woman covered from head to toe in the common chadri suddenly froze in the middle of traffic. A VW minibus struck her with a sickening thud, and she crumpled to the road, dead. I was riding in the front seat of that minibus on my way to a picnic in Pagman. We learned later that it was not the first time she had tried to commit suicide by dashing across a road and suddenly stopping in traffic. So many Afghans have fled to refugee camps in the neighboring countries, which continue to back either the Taliban or the anti-Taliban armies. But now all Afghans seem to me as vulnerable and as desperate as that woman. As I remember growing up in Kabul, I pray that we human beings around the world do what we can to silence the bells that toll for victims taken from our country's families and from those overseas by acts of war or terrorism. I pray that we remember, as John Donne once wrote, that any person's death diminishes us all. That we remember how Afghans and Americans alike are paralyzed by bombs, and that we all equally deserve to feel safe in our beds.
Andrew Brescia lives in Peterborough, New Hampshire. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How is the air war over Afghanistan or the anthrax scare here in the U.S. affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. Other radio diaries are featured online. Log onto wbur.org and click on special coverage. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage.